Skallerika, der Oro, der Oro i Marfil. Pare che su via la novia da chi d'usci.
Venimos a ver, venimos a ver. Y gazen y cantan y tengan mucho bien. Venimos a ver, venimos a ver. Y gazen y cantan y tengan mucho bien.
La novia no tiene dinero. Novia no tiene dinero. Que vos tenga un mazal bueno. Que vos
Venimos a ver, venimos a ver, y gazen y cantan y tengan mucho bien. Venimos a ver, venimos a ver, y gazen y cantan y tengan mucho bien.
La novia no tiene ducados, novia no tiene ducados, que vos tenga un mazal alto. Que vos tenga un mazal alto.
Venimos a ver, venimos a ver. Y gazen y cantan y tengan mucho bien. Venimos a ver, venimos a ver. Y gazen y cantan y tengan mucho bien.
Skallerika, de oro y marfil, para que subía la novia da aquí.
Hola amigos de Music in Two Flavors, Música en Dos Sabores. This is your host as always, Jaime Riera. How was your week? Mine, I can tell that mine was extremely hectic, let's say, hectic. So, how's the politics in your area? Good? How's the work? Good? I mean, mine is okay, it's not that great. For those of you that follows me on Twitter, I already have scheduled my surgery. Yep, I have my I'm gonna have my surgery 4 weeks from now. So I don't know yet if I'm gonna have an episode for that week. So it's gonna be trying to fix my cubital tunnel syndrome. That's the term, the medical term. So they guarantee that the numbness is gonna be there forever. That the nerve is gonna heal 1 millimeter per day, so that is like going to the moon. So I don't feel any anxiety for that surgery, so I'm okay. So I'm looking forward for that surgery. I want to get rid of that that nerve compression. So let's see what's going on that day. I wanted to thanks also to the University of Texas for the Latin American Music Review. I finished this volume 39, I think it is. Yeah, volume 39, number one. That's for our summertime. I'm just looking at it right now, and it has so magnificent articles about Latin American music. I mean, I was thrilled and excited to read it. I don't know which book I'm gonna pick now. I mean, I have so many books that I got from Thrift Books Store and Strand Book Store and from Amazon. I don't know which one to pick right now. So the other thing I want to do is thank my Patreons, my two Patreons. They asked to be anonymous, so those, I mean, you two know who you are. So thank you for your assistance, your economic help in keeping this podcast up. And what else do I have to say about? I don't know. Well, anyhow, let's talk about today's episode. Oh, yeah, I remember. I can't forget about this. We have a sponsor. Yes, we have a sponsor, and we have to thank Proyecto Amauta. Proyecto Amauta from Argentina is a sponsor of this podcast. And if you don't know Proyecto Amauta, and you don't know any Spanish, Proyecto Amauta is two words. It spells P-R-O-Y-E-C-T-O. And the other word is Amauta, A-M-A-U-T-A. And Proyecto Amauta has an objective in constructing Native American music instruments for educational and professional purposes. They built sikus, quenas, and different wind instruments in bamboo or other type of wood. And their objective is to educate children in sikus construction, and they have been for the last 13 years, I'm reading this of course, for 13 years they have been working on educating the kids in schools in Argentina about the Native American music, mostly folklore music from the Andean region, and they have a didactic purpose in these different schools in the federal capital of Buenos Aires and in the province of Buenos Aires. For the last 15 years, they have committed to spread Latin American culture, especially in the north of Argentina, to children and adults. Proyecto Amauta has a webpage, is proyectoamauta.com.ar, from Argentina, is P-R-O-Y-E-C-T-O, the other word is amauta.com.ar. So if you want to play the quena or the siku, and you want a luthier, I have my own quena from them, and it sounds magnificent. So if you want a quena, contact Proyecto Amauta, ask for Alejandro Andreu, and tell him that you listen to the ad, to the sponsorship through Music Into Flavors, and he will answer all your questions. On today's episode, I'm so full, I'm not gonna lie, I just finished cooking and eating. My dish today was spaghetti a la bolognese, as Pasquale, a former Italian chef I used to watch when I was like 15, 18 years old. I have his old recipe. So I cooked this spaghetti bolognese. I had like two plates of that. I love to eat. I'm gonna go to hell. I know. I'm gonna go to hell, definitely. I'm gonna be burning in hell. I'm a lawyer, musician, wannabe, and cook. And the three professions go to hell. That's what I heard. So, don't believe me. But let's not talk about my life, my afterlife. Let's talk about today's episode. On today's episode, I had the privilege, as always, of having and sitting in the Sinai Temple in Bethesda, and record this episode with Robin Helsner, who is a Jewish folklore musician. And she gave me a tour of the temple. And I've been in a synagogue before, and she showed me a Torah. And she showed me a Torah from, I hope I don't get this wrong. If I do, I apologize, Robin. I think it was from Poland. And it's a loan from the Polish people, and it has to be returned once the synagogue is reconstructed in Poland. So they have that Torah on loan, and it's so beautiful. I never thought about seeing skin goat. I'm sounding like Tom Hanks in the what was the name of the movie? Stranded, I think it was Stranded. Mason the Goat. You remember that part. We sat in a chapel in the Sinai Temple, and we talk about Sephardic music. We talk about Jewish music. We talk about the time she spent in USSR during the Perestroika. If you remember that was in 1989-1990. And we talk about everything about Jewish music and how the service in the temple is joyful, meaningful, and full of chants. So without further ado, let's listen to my interview with Robin Helsner. So Robin, thank you, first of all,
Welcome to Music in Two Flavors, Música en Dos Sabores. Thank you for making arrangements to be in this small venue here in the synagogue. It's Sinai Synagogue, right?
Temple Sinai.
Temple Sinai, at 3100 Military Road here in D.C. Thank you for making the arrangements, and thank you for the tour on the main chapel, or main...
Sanctuary.
Sanctuary.
Chapel, sanctuary.
It was, I love it. I love history, and I love everything about culture. And I always say that there are three doors to enter a culture. The first one is always food. That's why I told you, I love food. And living in New York for 2 years and eating different places, and New York is a big, huge Jewish community. There is no way that you cannot taste Jewish food, and they're so good. The other door to open is music. And Sephardic music, the first time I listened to Sephardic music was in 1986. And it was by accident. I was in college, and I was studying medieval story in Spain, and everything about what happened to the Moors and the Jewish, and when 15th century they were pushed away from, they were forced to leave Spain. I started to go deep in the Sephardic in that time. But then I realized I wanted to be a lawyer. Now I don't want to be a lawyer anymore. I'm talking too much. So thank you so much for everything.
You're welcome.
And for your music, because I listened to for six tracks you sent me, and they are amazing. So I'm
going to
see how I can put them in this recording, because I usually play around, and when I see a pause, I will play right there. So the audience will listen to your music. But let's start by asking, how do you start in music? How was your start?
I've been singing, performing Jewish music since I was 8 years old. Jewish music was always a part of my household. My father used to play records. Remember records?
Yeah, with the vinyl, yeah.
Yes, yes.
And the 8-tracks.
This was way before 8-tracks. These were really records.
We're talking 33 or 78? Last time I saw 78 was probably 19, my father had one. From 1950s.
We had all of the above. So I used to listen to these records, and they were in Hebrew and Yiddish mostly. Later when I got a little older is when I was more introduced to the Sephardic music as well. I guess we should probably say a little bit about these terms that we're using.
Sure, sure, sure.
So as a Jewish singer, I sing in what I call traditional Jewish languages, and that includes Hebrew, which is the ancient language of the Bible, the Torah, the five books of Moses, and now is the modern language of the State of Israel. I sing in Yiddish, which is a mixture of German and Hebrew, and this was a language that was spoken by the Jews who lived in Europe and Eastern Europe. And Ladino, or Judeo-Espanol. This is the language of the Sephardic.
Yeah, and that's one of the questions I have for you, because I've listened to people talking about Ladino and speaking to Sephardic, and they tried to regionalize geographically that the Sephardic was spoken only in Spain, on the peninsula, and the Ladino was spoken in the Balkans after they were forced out. But I always thought that both terms refer to the same language and the same people.
Exactly. So this is a language that was spoken by the Jews of Spain, as you mentioned, before they were expelled from Spain in 1492. So when the Jews were forced to leave Spain, they took their language with them. And as they moved from place to place, other languages would be added to the Sephardic language. So, for example, you mentioned the Jews went to the Balkans. They were welcomed in areas that were controlled by the Ottoman Turks, so the Ottoman Empire. So they went to the Balkans. They went to Turkey. They went to Greece. They went to North Africa. They went to the Middle East. They went to, originally, when they were first forced out, they went to Portugal. They went to the Netherlands. They eventually came to the New World. We're talking South America, the Caribbean, and eventually to North America. So when they left, they took their language with them, and then other words were added to them. So those Sephardim, those people who trace their lineage, the Jews who trace their lineage back to Spain, if they lived in Turkey, their Ladino language would be a mixture of Spanish, Hebrew, and Turkish.
Okay.
If they lived in North Africa, there was a big community in Morocco, their language, Ladino language, would be, let's say, Hebrew, Spanish, and Arabic or French, depending on
which part of the Morocco they were.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So just like the food we talked, you mentioned about the food, because there's a lot of cross-cultural pollination, and a lot of the Jewish food, as a lot of Jewish music, has been influenced by all the music and the cultures and the food and the countries where Jews have lived all over the world.
And it happens the same with the instruments.
Yes.
Because I've seen Jewish people playing, for example, in Greece, they play the Greek instruments for the music.
Sure.
So it happens, I mean, there's like a melting pot of different instruments, as the lute, as different Middle East instruments as well.
Of course, because the Jews, when they went to a country and they settled in a country, they assimilated into the country while keeping their Jewish traditions and the Jewish religion. They also became a part of the fabric of the country, of the economy of the country, and they felt themselves Greek, and they felt themselves Turkish, and they felt themselves Bulgarian, and they felt themselves Bosnian.
Without leaving their Jewish, the Jewish
yes,
heritage.
Yes, yes. So they felt themselves, which was the same thing in Western Europe, they felt themselves German, they felt themselves mm-hmm. French. So when some of these tragedies befell us in these parts of the world, for example in World War II, when Jews were considered to be other, it was quite a shock to mm-hmm. many of the community who had for centuries been living in these countries and felt themselves very much part of those nations. And you could see it in the music, mm-hmm. in the culture, in the food, that they were very much a part of the fabric of the nation in which they lived.
How different are the Jewish from China? Because I never thought about listening to Jewish in China and India.
So I don't know if you're making reference to one of my it's a little bit of an expertise, or one of my odd connections with the Jewish
community. I knew, for example, when I started to read the Jesuits' history and going, that was part of my times in college when I started like reading about how Christianity started to spread and the doctrine and philosophy and spreading their beliefs. And started with Marco Polo on the 1500s, probably, I think it was in the 1500s, but mostly a study regarding the Jesuits, that they went there and they, in a way, assimilated the music of India, of China, of Mongolia, and other Asia countries, in order to adopt their beliefs and make them embrace later on their beliefs. But I never thought about Jewish people. I never listened to Jewish music from China.
Right. So how I got to this was, I was invited to be a cantor, which is somebody who leads the music in the service for a congregation in Hong Kong. Now, the Jews who are in Hong Kong today are basically Westerners. They're expats from all over the world.
Okay.
It's a very international community. So I served as the cantor for this congregation for 6 years, and during that time, I met the head of the Jewish community in Beijing, who was a nice Jewish girl from New York, and I was invited to officiate at her son's bar mitzvah. So it was the first bar mitzvah that was ever held in Beijing. Now, this is the Jewish community today, which is mostly a modern community, certainly on mainland China. Now, if you go back to ancient times, you'll hear about a community that existed in a place called Kaifeng. So how did the Jews get there? This is like the 9th, 10th century. The Jews came from Iraq, well, what is now Iraq, mm-hmm. from Baghdad. These were Baghdadi Jews who were making their way across the Silk Road. They were merchants and traders.
Okay.
They came to this place, Kaifeng, which was a very international city. It was the capital of the Song Dynasty at the time. They saw that the Chinese were very friendly towards foreigners. They asked for permission from the emperor to settle in Kaifeng. The emperor gave them permission, and they were there. They settled there, and it was a community that was a flourishing community. They had a rabbi, they had Torahs, they had a mikveh, a ritual bath, they had a kosher butcher, they had everything. Actually, the first knowledge of Jews in China, this community, came in 1605 as a result of a meeting between a Jesuit priest and a Chinese Jew named Ai Tian. So this guy, Matteo Ricci, who was the Jesuit priest.
Oh, gosh, yeah. He's one of the followers of San Ignacio, yeah.
So he
Ricci's
met
one of them.
Ai Tian, and at first he thought that this man was a long-lost Christian. Well, Ai Tian, coming from his city of Kaifeng, had never even heard of Christianity because it wasn't there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he first thought that Ricci was a Jew, but he quickly figured out that Ricci was not Jewish when Ricci declared that the Messiah had already come. And for us, that hasn't happened yet. So the Jewish community, China is very interesting because unlike in other places in the world where the non-Jewish population was ghettoizing, expelling, murdering their Jews, mm-hmm. forcing them to convert
as
they did
in
Spain. China was different. Chinese saw the similarities between the two communities. We both have very long histories. Education is very important. We revere our ancestors. They saw so many similarities that the Chinese couldn't understand why the Jews wanted to separate themselves. As a result, they were very welcoming and the Jews began to assimilate.
Oh.
So much so that by the 1920s...
I'm having goosebumps already.
By the 1920s, the community was no longer viable. I mean, part of, I think also a part of their assimilation was due to the fact that this Jewish community was completely cut off from the rest of the world Jewish community. So they assimilated these Kaifeng Jews and they disappeared. Today, there are people in Kaifeng who claim that they are descendants of these original Chinese Jews. It's hard to tell, first of all. It's been a long time. Second of all, traditional Judaism, the religion is passed down through the mother. And many of these people are claiming more patrilineal descent than matrilineal descent. So there's sort of questions about it, but there are some people who claim that they're descendants of the Jews who are rediscovering their Judaism. And several of them have moved to Israel, where they are now, you know, living as Israelis.
And is it big? I mean, is the community big right now in
China? No. It really doesn't exist.
Okay.
It really doesn't exist. These are just sort of individuals who are coming together, maybe in a small group, to sort of reclaim what they say is their Jewish background.
How were your years in the former Soviet Union? Because I know that you used to play on the ground.
Yes, yeah, so that's...
And we're talking about before Gorbachev, or it was after Gorbachev, during the... Gosh, I forgot his name already. It was after Gorbachev was... Yeltsin.
So I was there during the Gorbachev time.
Okay.
So this is another part of Jewish history. Jews had been persecuted in the Soviet Union mm-hmm. for a very long time.
During the Stalin time.
And after, during Brezhnev, you name it.
Khrushchev, Brezhnev.
Yes. So they were very much oppressed. They were not allowed to study anything, to live as Jews, to study anything having to Judaism, and they were discriminated against. So there was a movement came about from a lot of young people to request to leave. And we had a whole then dissident movement. If you requested permission to leave the country, you were thrown out of your job. You could be thrown in prison for protesting. There was a lot that was happening to these Jews in the Soviet Union. So we here in the United States, there was a grassroots effort, how it started, was to bring the plight of the Jews in the Soviet Union to the attention of the world. And there was a slogan that we used to say, let them live or let them leave. If they can't live as Jews, they want to live as Jews, let them leave the country, let them leave the Soviet Union, let them live
without consequences.
Without consequences. So as I was growing up, this became a very important movement, and there were a lot of protests that happened here in Washington, D.C. The very large one in the 1980s during the time of the Reagan administration. There were about 250,000 people down in D.C., downtown, protesting one of the largest demonstrations that was had. And we were bringing this attention to the world. The Jackson-Vanik Amendment was talking about linking Jewish immigration to trade with the Soviet Union. So the profile was rising in the world. At the time, the Jewish community was sending Jewish educators, Jewish leaders to the Soviet Union to try and meet with Jewish people there, bring in materials whenever possible, and just to let them know they hadn't been forgotten. Mm-hmm. So I was sent to the Soviet Union. The first time was in 1988. And it was the first time that this community, this DC community, had ever sent a Jewish folk singer. And I was amazed by the reception that I received. Everywhere I went, I met people hungry to hear this music. I learned a little bit of Russian so I could get on the public payphones, because you couldn't call people from hotel phones. You had to assume that
it
they were
tapped.
Bugged.
Yeah, it was tapped.
So I was given some names and telephone numbers of people to call. I would go to the payphones and, you know, call the person and say, Minya zavut Robin Helsner, my name is Robin Helsner. You know, Ya zhivu v Washingtoni, and I live in Washington. Ya ispelnyayu yevreisky piesny, I sing Jewish songs. And then, somehow or other, very quickly, they would arrange for a meeting in somebody's apartment, because Jews could not rent a public space to hold a public meeting. So we would meet in an apartment of a particular person, and people found out about it, and they would come. The apartments were packed, and we sang for hours.
And nothing happened? I mean, there were no...
I think I was very fortunate. Again, it was the time of Gorbachev, so it was around the time of Glasnost Perestroika, mm-hmm. where things started to open up. And even though we were very careful, and I know one apartment we went to, the... I think it was a grandmother's apartment or the mother's apartment, they were very uncomfortable that they were there. Things could happen, but I was really fortunate and met a lot of people and refuseniks, people who had been refused permission to leave after they had requested permission to leave. So that was in 1988. The reception was amazing.
So the music you play there, were folk music related to like religious songs?
Everything. Just Jewish music, folk songs. And we should talk about that. Let me just finish this story and then we'll come back to even what we're talking about when we say Jewish music. So as a result of that first trip in 1988, I was invited back in 1989 to be a part of the first officially government-sanctioned Jewish cultural tour to the Soviet Union in 70 years. So from going from underground concerts where I was calling people on payphones and coming to apartments where we were looking over our shoulders, the next time I went, I was singing in Tchaikovsky Hall in Moscow, a 3,000-seat auditorium. The place was packed. Given the opportunity to reconnect with their Jewish roots, the people were thrilled to have the opportunity to do
so. It was in 1989 that the Soviet Union broke up and started to become Russia and then the different countries.
Right, so I was there in February. Well, it was 1990 was when the wall
1990,
came
you're
down.
Right.
Right.
It was 1990.
Right, so I was there in February 89 and the wall
came
down.
Yeah, it was
down.
Almost dismantled. I mean,
yes,
the
things
Russia
started,
part
exactly.
To break down
exactly.
The so old-fashioned.
That's way. Why we were even able to do that. Things had sort of moved and opened up that much where we could perform in the concert.
Is it still the same now?
In regards to
in
what?
In regards to, open, to these openings, allowing people to follow their beliefs.
Well, it certainly is more open. You know, my feeling is it was not a place for Jews. And a lot of Jews have left the country. Many of them have come to the United States, to Israel. And there's a very large Jewish, Russian Jewish population in Germany and in Europe, yeah, which is very interesting.
How about Spain?
Spain.
Let's go back to Spain. And we were talking on the phone before, I mean, say, trying to scale and doing all these arrangements. I mean, one of the things that, after all the readings I did about Spain and the Jewish community in Spain in the 15th century, and these days, I haven't heard anything about the leaders of the country apologizing to the Jewish people for the wrong or the mistake they made in 1492 of throwing them out. I told you that if the Jewish stay in Spain, things will be different in Spain. I'm talking about the whole spectrum of culture, of food, or mathematics, philosophy, music, even religion, would be so different. And probably what happened in 1930s probably would never happen if the Jewish people were part of the community and not forced out.
So one of the other things that I do in my various, in my career, which is including giving concerts of Jewish music and leading the music at in religious services in the synagogue as a cantor, I also...
You have these tours.
I lead these tours, these Jewish heritage tours. So I've taken groups to China. I've taken groups to the Balkans, to Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. And I also took a group to Spain not too long ago. So what we found in Spain, well, first of all, we should say that when the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, that order of expulsion, the Edict of Expulsion, signed by Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, was in effect for almost 500 years.
See?
And it was only rescinded around in the 1960s.
During Franco?
Yes.
Wow, I never thought about that,
yes.
About Franco.
Now, there's another interesting thing. So the expulsion from Spain, which in many Jewish communities, they're very... Ashkenazi-centered, so more Europe and Eastern Europe than being part of the Spanish culture. So in that way, we don't learn as much as we should about the Sephardic culture, about Jews in Spain, and about the expulsion. The expulsion was like a Holocaust for the Jewish community. It tore the community apart. The Jews were left destitute because they were forced out without being able to take anything with them. Traveling was dangerous, and many Jews died as they were trying to get to their next place. It was a horror for the Jewish community, for the Jews. It was also a horror for those that were left. If you wanted to remain in Spain, you had to convert to Catholicism. And these people were called conversos.
Yeah, Judeo conversos, yeah.
Yes.
But they were converse only on his face, but deeply they were not converse. They're still doing things underground because they do it in order to be safe, to survive.
It's true for many of them. I mean, some you just had to convert, and they converted, and that was that. But there were a number of people who kept their Jewish practices in secret. But it was very, very dangerous. There's a little bit of confusion. The Inquisition that was established in Spain,
Los Autos de Fe,
yes, was not against the Jews. It was against these conversos.
Heresy. Yeah.
Yes. So what people could be accused of was heresy, which they meant they were Judaizing. They were practicing Judaism in secret, whether it was true or whether it was not true. Once you were accused,
you're finished. Yeah, that's your end. Yeah.
Yes, and it was old. It's anti-Semitism and old jealousies in the Catholic Church, because if a Jew converted, often the restrictions placed on Jews were no longer applicable. Mm-hmm. So that person could rise in Spanish society, and when the Church and the non-Jewish community saw that these people, these conversos, were doing very well, they became jealous and they wanted to take them down. How best to take them down?
Saying that they were practicing Judaism.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Church could confiscate everything that person owned, that the converso owned, for their own property.
Of course.
So
it's the old Holocaust. It was a Holocaust.
Yes.
It's the same procedure.
Exactly.
I mean, Hitler didn't invent anything. He just duplicated whatever happened in 1500s and whatever. It was the same.
So there were people who left, and we talked about this a little bit, that there were conversos. Mm-hmm. On Columbus's ship, when he came, his second voyage to New World in 1493 and landed in Puerto Rico, there were definitely conversos on his ship. There were conversos that came to Mexico. There were a lot of people who came to try to escape the Inquisition. Unfortunately, Inquisition followed them, even to the New World, to New Spain, which was Mexico and these other places. And it was, the Inquisition was in effect until the 1800s.
Yeah,
they harassed these poor people. The Church has never apologized.
Never apologized.
So, okay, so that's right. That's what the Church. Now, the Spanish government did rescind the Edict of Expulsion. Jews have been living under the radar in Spain for a while. today, you see, I met when I was there some university students who were looking into this heritage, the history of Jews in Spain, because they start to see, they start to hear about Jews in Spain, and they wonder, well, where are they?
And who are they?
Who are they? What happened to them? And so there is now an interest amongst the young people to sort of begin exploring this history. There are actually Jewish centers, cultural centers in many cities, and Jewish museums in many cities in Spain today that are were established and are run by non-Jews. And there is one kind of positive story in all of this historically. During, we'll come back again, during World War II, during the Holocaust, Jews in France, or who were trying to escape the Nazis, there were some who were escaping, tried to escape over the Pyrenees to get to Spain. It was a very dangerous way to go. You couldn't necessarily make it, and it's very treacherous, and the terrain is difficult. But if a Jewish person could get over the Pyrenees and into Spanish territory, the Spaniards protected them. They did not send them back against
over the border.
And some people think that this was partly a way of them atoning for the terrible things that they had done to their Jewish neighbors in the past. And so they welcomed them. Once they got into Spain, they were kept in Spain. They were sent to Barcelona, to Girona. They were sent to places where they could recover and then move on to America or wherever else.
Okay.
So that's the one positive thing in the midst of this horrible
story. It was Catalans.
It was the Catalans. Yes, it was the Catalans.
They're very different.
You know what? So there's a thought that because people kept their Jewish heritage secret, or had to, and little things were passed down from generation to generation, I have read that there's a thought that there may be 20% of Spaniards today are descended from
Sephardic
Jews.
Yeah.
And in Catalan, it's a higher percentage.
Yeah, it's a higher percentage.
Yes.
Yeah, I know that. I know that. And the people in Seville also.
Yes.
Many Andalusian people
Well, that was the heart of
actually,
Jewish
Spain. Actually, it was the heart of culture
was
in Spain. It was Spain.
Sevilla, Córdoba, and Granada.
Yeah, that was the heart of the culture.
Yes.
Everything
and
was
Toledo.
There. Yeah, Toledo, yeah.
Toledo has two synagogues that
are
still...
I didn't know that about Toledo. I thought Toledo was a Catholic realm.
There was a yeshiva, a school, where people used to come to study with famous rabbis and scholars in Toledo.
I didn't know. Well, you're
and
right. You're
two
right.
Synagogues that remain are in Toledo. They were, of course, confiscated, made into churches, and now they're public museums.
Oh, mm-hmm. I've never been in Toledo.
You
so
must
that,
go.
I have to go to Toledo. So how do you learn, in your? I know that you sing your folk songs in Yiddish and Hebrew. Probably Hebrew you learn from your home, but Yiddish, and Sephardic.
Sephardic. So the Hebrew I learned going to Hebrew school, going to religious school as part of my Jewish education growing up. We learned to read Hebrew. I certainly learned in the synagogue a lot of songs. I was part of a youth group, so I learned a lot of Hebrew songs, a lot of songs from Israel. And the Hebrew is from my own education and knowledge.
Is it hard to learn?
I don't think so. You could, you know, as we were talking about, it depends. Hebrew is not as difficult as English, certainly. It's a much easier language.
How about the grammar?
The grammar
is easier than English or German. German grammar is difficult.
Russian grammar is difficult. If it's not your own language,
everything
it's
is
difficult. It's difficult. So Hebrew is something that I grew up with, very much a part of my education. Yiddish came from my father and my mother. My grandparents were all foreign born. They were all Eastern European. And the language that was spoken in their household was Yiddish. The first language of my father and my mother was Yiddish. That's what they spoke in the house. And it was only when they went to school that they learned English.
Okay.
So Yiddish was a language that they would speak to each other when they didn't want us to know what they were saying.
Okay.
Which is unfortunate. This is sort of the immigrant story where you have those that come from abroad, the immigrants that come, so they're speaking their native language. Their children learn it. That's the first generation. And then they want to be more American. They want to assimilate. So they don't want to speak Yiddish. And unfortunately for me, the second generation, they didn't pass it on. The way they did pass it on, though, is through the singing, through the music. I can't speak Yiddish, but I can sing in Yiddish.
But you can understand it, right?
And I work with my father and other Yiddish speakers to learn to pronounce the words correctly and to learn what it means.
And Sephardic. What do you
and
mean
Sephardic? Then I also learn from native speakers, from people who speak Ladino, and from recordings. You hear a lot of recordings. I've listened to a lot of recordings.
Sephardic is like a mix of Latin, Spanish, and Hebrew?
Spanish and Hebrew.
Okay, because sometimes I can understand the words, but then on the Sephardic songs, there are like words I can understand the phrases during the romanceros or las coplas from Sephardic music. But then there are phrases that there is no Spanish at all.
So Ladino is a very old Spanish, because you have to then imagine, if people are speaking Spanish until 1492, mm-hmm. after that their Spanish vocabulary is not
necessarily extended
or evolving. Mm-hmm. So it's an old Spanish that, as I understand, linguists who are interested in studying Spanish are going and studying Judeo-Espanol, because that's really a truer old Spanish that they can get to than what is spoken in Spain today.
Wow. I didn't know that about their linguistics. So one of the things that I noticed in Sephardic music, and I find it very interesting, is that most of the singers are women. For example, in the coplas, romanceros, there is mostly women singing. There is no men singing romanceros or coplas. Of all the recordings I've been listening to, I have been reading, they were saying that the romancero was music only to be sung by women.
That I'm not aware of that, because I grew up listening to a lot of singers singing Ladino music who were men. So it may be that there's some things from the home, lullabies.
Lullabies, one of them, romanceros.
Sure. Things having to do, right, or romanceros having to do with the home, or some of those love songs, a lot of unrequited love songs. And I can see that would probably be sung by women.
What's the most common topic in music in the Jewish community, in folk song, like, besides religious, using the Psalms? Because I know that from the prophetic books, most of them are sung. But what other topics, like daily life, struggle, whatever happening before, and bringing back like history, like remembrance?
You can sing about anything. So you can sing about home, you can sing about family, you can sing about work, you can sing about struggle, you can sing
about
love. You can sing about anything. What makes it Jewish, in my opinion, it's that it's sung in a traditional Jewish language. So we have such a rich Jewish cultural heritage. All these songs and all these traditional languages about all these topics. So then you have there's a lot of folk songs in all the different languages about all the different themes that we mentioned, just a few that are Jewish because they're sung in traditional Jewish languages. Then you have all sorts of songs about holidays, all the Jewish holidays in all these different languages. Then you have songs that are music that is set to the liturgy. So then you have some things that are more religious in nature. And then you have melodies that they set the Psalms to, for example. And then we were talking about this, the Torah, our five books of Moses that we read every week on Shabbat, on our Sabbath, and on holidays. It's not just read, it's chanted.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So there's a melody for chanting for chanting the Torah. And it's not just one melody, because different communities have their own ways of chanting Torah. They have their own melodies.
So there is no a pattern. There is no a rule how to perform the chant?
For each community, they have their own rules of how to do it. Each community has their own melody.
And when we talk about communities, are we talking about communities in the same country or communities in different countries?
I say communities in different countries.
So the Iraqi people... There is no rule. Well, there is no accolade to follow the same pattern of singing the praises or singing the Torah. You sing it as you wanted to do it, but sing it.
Right.
As
so
long
and
as
mostly
it's happiness.
In the United States, we sing it with a particular, it's called a trope, a particular way that we sing it, but Iraqi Jews will sing it differently, and Moroccan Jews will sing it differently.
And they use instruments, or they are not allowed to use
instruments? It depends where you are, because we have in
and the day.
On the day or what kind of congregation
because
you are.
Because I know in Shabbat you can all play.
It depends. In more progressive congregations, we do use instruments on Shabbat. In a more Orthodox congregation, they would not use instruments on Shabbat. So you have music for chanting Torah. Then you have music for chanting the prayers. And that also, there are different melodies for different services depending on what day they are and what holiday they are and what time they are. It's quite a large amount of music and melodies for different things, for different services, for different occasions, for different holidays, and just for singing about life.
That's the thing that was intriguing me when I started knowing more about Jewish music, is that there is no sad songs in Jewish music.
No sad songs?
Yeah.
Oy vey. We got plenty of sad songs.
But, I mean...
And actually, it's funny that you say that because...
But sad songs, like, there is like a tragic ending. They're always trying to bring happiness. They're trying to make everything... I mean, before difficult times, they're trying to make it look positive. Bring the positive from it. And they use... I mean, why I read... Well, I mean, we're talking about 1920. It was like a paragraph I read, and that's why I bought the book, is that... They can go through the worst of times, but singing will make those worst of times better.
I think that's true for everyone, for every culture. I think that's why often people sing, because there's something about it's a spiritual thing. It's an emotional thing, and you can come out of yourself when you sing. And I think that. What's interesting about you say there's no sad songs, many Jewish songs are in a minor key or a minor mode.
Okay.
And to most people, I mean, to me, that sounds like home. That's so comfortable to me, much more than in a major key. But for more people who are non-Jews, let's say, who are more familiar with things in a major key, which is so a lot of the church melodies are in major keys, major mode, and they hear a Jewish song in a minor mode, and they'll say, "That sounds so sad."
Very sorrowful.
It's very sorrowful. And I've had. I remember one sound man.
But I listen to Jewish music, but I don't feel sad.
Well, that's because you have some Jewish soul.
I told you, I might be Sephardic.
You
I
might
don't
be
know.
Sephardic. You have to go now do the genealogy and figure it out. But I do. I remember a sound man at one of my concerts saying, you know, the music sounded so sad, but the audience was so happy, you know, that mm-hmm. for them it feels comfortable. It feels like our tradition, and it feels like our roots.
When we talk about instruments in music, in Jewish music, and I know I'm saying Jewish music probably in the wrong term, but I mean, Jewish music embraces different kind of genres. What is the most typical instrument in folk music, Jewish folk music, besides guitar? Is there percussion? There is
violin,
banjo.
Probably.
Violin, I knew about that in the Western, Eastern Europe, because I knew many Jewish people played the violin in Eastern culture. It was like the, first it was classical music. I mean, the best classical composers in the 20th century are Jewish. Leonard Bernstein, we have George Gershwin, we have this violinist, I forgot his name, he's still alive. What's his name? He's played classical music.
Perlman.
No, it's... Oh, gosh, I forgot. It's Chuck Perlman. Perlman. You're right, Perlman, you said the name. Perlman. So beside the violin and the guitar, is there any percussion?
Yes.
I know they have the tambourine, yes, but there's no tambourine that we know.
It depends where you are, what kind of instruments. Again, this is what's going to come from the culture. If you go to the Middle East, you go to North Africa, you go to the Balkans, they're going to be playing what everybody else is playing. A word that people might have heard or are more familiar with, klezmer. Klezmer mm-hmm. music, for example. This is sort of traditional Eastern European music with a Jewish twist. And it comes from the Hebrew klezmer, which are instruments of music. That's what it means. And these were often wandering minstrels who used to go from village to village, from place to place, playing instruments for weddings, for celebrations, whatever. And they would play. You see pictures from some of the old klezmorim, some of the old klezmer musicians, and they're playing fiddle, and they're playing some sort of percussion drum, and they're playing maybe a wind instrument. Clarinet is a big thing,
yeah.
And you'll hear. But it Jewish music, there's no instrument that this is a Jewish instrument. When in one of my in my group, in my trio, for some of the songs, one of the members of my group has started to play dobro.
Oh God, no.
Yes. And it's so much fun. Dobro, of course, it's an American instrument.
It's an American instrument.
And it sounds
it's very
great.
Metallic, yeah.
But it really works.
Bluesy, it's very bluesy.
It's very much in bluegrass music, yep. In country music, that's where you'll hear the dobro. And he's brought it into our music. Why not? We're Americans, we're playing Jewish music, and this is a part of American culture, and it works with the songs. I mean, we don't use it for everything. We're very careful about where it fits in. But it's lovely. So
one of the things I like about, I mean, I knew that Pete Seeger was Jewish, mm-hmm. and he played, mm-hmm. he wasn't Jewish? Mm-hmm. I thought he was Jewish because he sang Jewish songs.
He sang Tzena Tzena.
Yeah.
One song, yes.
No, there's another video, it's,
maybe some Yiddish song.
Tihuglak, what was the name? I don't remember the name. But I saw him playing with this Jewish singer, and he was playing the banjo. I thought he was Jewish. Gosh, delete that.
Yeah.
Those who are listening to this, delete that.
We can't claim everybody.
Of course you can. He has some Jewish blood somewhere, I mean,
maybe.
Some heritage somewhere. But how folk Jewish music started in the U.S.? How it started in the same movement? Because I know that Bob Dylan is Jewish.
Yes.
He's Jewish.
Yes.
So when Bob Dylan started playing folk music and seeing soul other like Carole King and other musicians, folk music got a peak, like a resurgence of, or was renovated after Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger trying to bring back folk music. How do you start playing folk music and why folk music?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I grew up in the 60s.
Well, yeah.
I was a kid in the 60s, and so everybody was playing folk music. Everybody was playing guitar. I mean, that was like, you're talking about Bob Dylan and all these other, that's what we were listening to then. Peter, Paul, and Mary. People were picking up guitars and playing music. So that's what I was, my environment, and I learned to play guitar.
And what's the topic, your main topic in your folk music, your folk songs?
For me, it's been Jewish music. Somehow that's where I feel most connected. I mean, I grew up singing and playing American folk songs as well, but I feel so comfortable singing Jewish music. It just has meaning for me. When I sing in these different traditional Jewish languages, the language comes alive, the melodies come alive, and it's sort of become my mission to share Jewish music with the world.
Has been transferred to any other communities, the folk Jewish music, outside from the U.S. as well? Or is it only play here in the U.S.?
No, all over the world. All over the world. There are Jewish musicians all over the world. And some of them are not even Jewish. There are German singers, for example, who are rediscovering the Yiddish music. Yiddish is very close to German. And so for them, it's not very difficult to sing in Yiddish. They're rediscovering the music. Sephardic music is very popular all over the world, particularly in Spanish-speaking mm-hmm. countries, because it's Spanish. It's basically Spanish. So Jewish music is popular all over the world.
But is there any genre between those communities that, I mean, in a way, the word in Spanish would be resalta, like you can see it more played or replicated in different places than other genres? Like, for example, folk music can be played anywhere and people will identify that genre. It would be the same for Jewish music?
I think klezmer music has really, crossed over?
Mm-hmm, crossover.
Yes, I think klezmer music has really crossed over. That's what people seem to know best and most, which klezmer music is sort of traditional Eastern European dance music. And there is a resurgence of interest in klezmer music in this country, and it's filtered out throughout the U.S. and throughout the world.
Regarding the holidays in Jewish services, is there any prohibition to play certain instruments in certain holidays or to sing certain topics in certain holidays?
Well,
like for example, Yom Kippur, are you allowed to play instruments that day? I mean, you said that there are some communities that have some latitude in allowing you to play instruments, and others are too orthodox, that because it breaks a string, that means that you have to work and put a string back, and you are forbidden to work that holiday.
No, it's a prohibition against playing musical instruments at any service from an orthodox perspective. And so you wouldn't hear instruments at all. In other congregations where instruments are permitted, then they can be played at any service.
Okay.
Including on Yom Kippur, on one of our holiest days, which is a fast day, the Day of Atonement. There are congregations where music will be played as it is throughout the year. But there is music specific and melody specific to Yom Kippur that are only sung on Yom Kippur. You'll never hear that melody at another service throughout the year. Yes. Yes.
And is it the same for other holidays? Or
yes.
Just
the same for other holidays. There are certain melodies, liturgical melodies. We call it Nusach. And there is Nusach, these different melodies for different services. So I sort of like to tell this story. It's kind of fun that if you had somebody who was marooned on a desert island and didn't know what day it was, what time it was, whatever, and let's say they came to get him off the desert island and he had been in the sun, so they covered his eyes, you know, because he needed to just adjust or something. His eyes were covered, and they took him into a synagogue. He didn't know what day it was. He didn't know what time it was. He didn't know, yeah. And if he could listen to the melody of the prayers being sung in a traditional synagogue, let's say, where they use these traditional melodies, he could listen to the prayers that are sung, being sung, and he could tell you what day it is, what time it is, and what if it was a holiday. Because the melody that's sung, let's say, on a Shabbat, which our holidays always start in the evening, so Friday night is when our Sabbath begins. So we have a service on Friday evening for Shabbat, Saturday morning, and Saturday afternoon. Each of those services have different melodies for the same prayers. So you could, as I say, be blindfolded. And if you heard a particular melody,
you
would know if it's Friday night, Saturday morning, or Saturday afternoon.
Even for the same prayer?
Yep. For the same prayer.
Wow. I didn't know that. Well, I don't know that much about Judaism and Jewish celebrations. But I find it fascinating how they can make melody, different melodies for the same prayer.
Yes.
It has any purpose?
Yes, it has the purpose to enhance the prayer and your experience of the prayer, which I think all music, for me, that's the purpose. I mean, to be pleasing to the ear, of course, but to enhance the lyrics, whatever they are.
How important is music in Jewish service?
Totally. For me? You're asking me?
For a rabbi, for any rabbi.
It's very, very important.
And for the audience that...
For the congregation.
Yeah.
And not only that, I think it's very important that the congregation participates. The congregation sings along. That's what prayer is. And the cantor, my job is to facilitate the prayer, and I facilitate it with song and with participation.
When you talk about, I mean, when you say cantor, what does cantor stand for?
For those
who doesn't know.
Yes, a cantor, it's the English word for a title for somebody who who leads the music at a service. The Hebrew word, one Hebrew word is chazan, which is also cantor, or shaliach tzibor. I really like this one. Shaliach tzibor is...
That sounds so so nice. I mean, it looks like Yiddish, right?
That's Hebrew,
okay.
Shaliach tzibor. And a shaliach tzibor, I guess you would translate it as a messenger for the community. So what is the role of the shaliach tzibor, which is really what a cantor is a shaliach tzibor. The shaliach tzibor's role is to facilitate the congregation's prayers.
Okay. It's like a choral director in music, in a way, being your choral on the congregation.
I'm helping the congregation in their own experience of prayer with music. And I think that's the highest way that you pray is through song.
So how do you manage to have the congregation follow the same rhythm?
I'm a strong leader.
I mean, for someone who's coming for the first time from different congregation, how he can follow the same rhythm if the prayer was sung in a different tone or rhythm?
A different melody.
Yeah.
They would have to adapt. They would hear it one time, then maybe they'd be a little lost, and then the next time they hear it, it sounds a little bit more familiar, and the next time they hear it, they can sort of sing along, and the next time that they hear it, it's part of their tradition.
Let's talk about your trio, because I know you mentioned you have a trio. How did the trio form? You were the founder of it, right?
Yes.
Was founded after your Soviet Union underground trip? Or it was before that?
You know, I had a trio. I think this particular grouping, I think that it did solidify after the Soviet Union trips, because I realized that I had something to say, I had something to sing, and I wanted to share with people, and that I could only do it in a concert form. So that's really when the trio solidified, even though I had been playing with musicians prior to that. And one of the members of the trio, I've been playing with him from the very beginning, so that's many, many decades. And the third member of the trio, we've had three different people, and each of them, the first one was named Mark, the second one was named Mike, and the third one is named Matt. And that's it.
Too much coincidence.
Yes, it is. Each of those was an M. And this is the trio as it is right now. Matt Holson, Dove Whiteman, and myself.
Matt is the one that you say looks like me.
Yes.
Okay.
Who grew up in Spain and Chile, so speaks Spanish. And
Have you been in Chile?
I have not.
But have you been in Argentina?
I have not.
No, you have to go there.
Not yet.
You have to go to Argentina.
Not yet. Yeah, it's a very strong Jewish community in Argentina.
Yes. I met many Jewish people in Argentina, Buenos Aires, and they are lovely.
Yeah.
I told you it's the second biggest community after the Hispanics in Argentina, the Spanish speaking.
Your wife is from Argentina,
yeah,
is that correct?
So
the three of us sing, so our signature is our three-part harmonies, and then different instruments.
Have five records, two for kids, and three, one with a trio, and the two...
Three with the trio, okay. And two for children.
The songs for the children, are they about Jewish history, culture?
The songs for the children...
Or is about everything?
Yeah, also everything. And the songs for kids are a mixture of songs for Shabbat in Hebrew, in Yiddish. I don't know that I have any Ladino songs. How did that happen? Well, so they're in Hebrew, Yiddish, and English. And so half of the recording are songs for the Sabbath, for celebrating Shabbat. And the other half are American folk songs. So kids listen to them year-round, every day. And they hear both American folk songs and Jewish folk songs for the Sabbath.
And they love it?
They love it. All over the world, kids are singing these songs. Because this is kind of fun for Sephardic, since I know that's of great interest to you. So I always think about love songs. We talked about love songs. Mm-hmm. And I sort of think about love songs in the Jewish tradition. And love songs in Hebrew are full of lyricism and poetry. We use songs from Shir HaShirim, from the Song of Songs, the book The Song of Songs, and they're really gorgeous love songs in Hebrew. So then I think about love songs in Ladino. Love songs in Ladino and Judeo-Espanol are full of passion and full of threats. So, for example, there are many Ladino love songs, mm-hmm. like this one that I'm going to sing. He says, I walked by your house, but the door was locked. So I kissed the lock as if I were kissing your face.
Oh!
That's passion, yes?
Yes.
And here's the next part, though.
How's the threat.
If you do not love me, you will lose your beauty, no one will find you worthy, and you will die in my arms.
Oh, gosh.
That's Ladino love.
Avre este abajur biju, avre natu ventana, por ver tu cara morena, al yo daré mi alma, por ver tu cara morena, al yo daré mi alma. Por la puerta yo pasé, yo la topí cerrada, la llave dura yo besé, como besar tu cara. La llave dura yo besé, como besar tu cara. Si tú de mí te olvidarás, tu hermosura piedra, ningún niño te engañará, en los mis brazos mueras, ningún niño te engañará, en los mis brazos mueras. Oh, abre este abajur, biju, abre la tu ventana, por ver tu cara morena, al yo daré alma, por ver tu cara morena, al yo daré mi alma.
Wow, I love it. I love it. I never heard that one. I heard La Morena. I heard all the Sephardi songs. How do you learn the chords?
I learned them. I'm a true folk musician. I never have sheet music.
Gosh.
I listen. That's how I learn things. I'm an oral learner. I hear the song, I listen, and I figure out the chords.
Gosh. Yeah, you have like five chords there. You have C, A, D, and I think it was G.
E, right. B minor.
B minor.
Yeah.
You have D,
yeah.
You have C.
Right.
You have A.
G.
A minor. You have A minor.
Yes. Yes.
For those who play guitars know what I'm talking about.
For those who play guitar, you know A minor and D minor and E, you can play a lot of Jewish songs.
Gosh, yeah. I'm gonna start playing those chords.
You can
now.
Play a lot of Jewish songs.
And it's mostly strumming and
That's how I am. Here's the thing, I'm an interpreter. That's how I consider my role. I'm an interpreter of these songs. So I hear these songs, I learn these songs, and it gets filtered through me, Robin Helsner, this person at this time, and maybe my gender and my voice and my playing. So I'm interpreting, and that's how I interpret that song. Somebody, you might hear it from somebody else, and it's going to sound different,
yeah.
And it's going to be a different cadence and a different
rhythm. Melody, yeah. But the funny thing is that I listened to your song right now, listened to you singing that song, it was completely Sephardic. It was true Sephardic. I mean, I'm not an expert Sephardic, but I listened to many records on Sephardic, and it brought back the memories in the 1980s when I listened to Sephardic for the first time.
It's a traditional Sephardic song.
It's lovely.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yes,
and the way
too.
You pronounce the words, I mean, those who speak Spanish might understand what you were saying. I mean, it's not that hard. Judeo Espanol is not hard to understand.
Correct.
It's very easy.
If you're a Spanish speaker, yes.
I'm completely without words to describe my feelings right now. I love it. What else do you have there? How about Psalms? I mean, I know Psalms. The funny part about Psalms is that in I mean, at least in Catholic, they don't sing it. They just repeat the words.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that probably elementary, the priest will tell me that psalms are supposed to sing, but the better people to sing it would be a choral or the priest.
So psalms also, we sing.
And psalms, I thought that was written for singing.
Yes, they were. They were sung. And unfortunately, we no longer know how they were sung. So we know from Torah, when I was mentioning about Torah trope, and that has been passed down, that we know how the Torah was chanted, mm-hmm. and we have developed nusach melodies for singing the prayers in the services. We've lost that. We've lost the melodies of the Psalms. We don't
No,
this is an oral tradition.
Yeah.
It's only recently that anything has been recorded or written down or that notated. Everything, the notation, everything is very, in a way you could say contemporary, because this was an oral tradition for the most part that was handed down from generation to generation. So we no longer know how the Psalms were chanted, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
So what people have done, though, many composers, is they've taken lyrics from the Psalms and they have set music to it. So we have many songs that the lyrics are from the Psalms.
Okay.
So we could do Psalm 150, for example, is the last psalm in the Book of Psalms. And it talks about all the ways to praise the Creator. It talks about praising with singing, with playing instruments.
Like,
yes, with banging, with playing the drum.
Well, thank you for bringing that out, because I read that there are some Orthodox that says that songs should be sing only, not play. But then there are another ethnomusicologist that said that there is a psalm that says that there is music, instruments, and that in order to be heard, you have to do everything the psalms tells you to do.
Yes, there is a tradition that in some of the Orthodox congregations that we don't play instruments as a remembrance of the destruction of the temples in Jerusalem in ancient times. And but they will play instruments at concerts. I mean, there's during regular times, just not during services. But I have to think that there were a lot of instruments played in ancient days during our celebrations and holidays because of what Psalm 150 says, celebrating with playing the drum, with dancing, with singing.
Dancing. Jews love to dance.
With playing, crashing the cymbals. And it says with the entire being, with every breath.
It's like trying to release the spirit from the body.
Well, that's how you praise. That's how you praise the Creator, with every part of your being, through singing, through dancing, through playing in musical instruments. Just the act of breathing is an act of praise.
I never thought about that.
And this is what it says, Kol ha-neshama tehalelia, with every soul, with every breath, tehalelia, praise God. So that's what this is the repeating chorus of the song, of this song with Psalm 150. And the Hebrew word, the word hallelujah, is a Hebrew word. Hallel is to praise.
Okay.
And Yah is a short form of
God.
Name Yahweh, for God.
Yahweh. I think it's Yahweh, right?
Right, which we don't pronounce. That Yud Heh Vav Heh is a word.
Okay.
No, and it's you'll see it Yahweh or whatever it is.
Okay.
For us, it's an unpronounceable word.
Okay, then you know that. Sorry.
No. We have other ways that we say the name of God. Hallelujah is a Hebrew word.
So it's a way to praise.
And it's
praise.
And it's that's what he says. Praise God. That's what it means.
Okay. Thank you.
you.
I love it.
And there are many other melodies that use these same lyrics. So this is not the only one. That's what composers have been doing for centuries, is they've been taking lyrics and setting music to them. So this is just one particular setting from Barak Amrani, who is an Israeli. This was his way of interpreting Psalm 150. Somebody else will take another melody and interpret Psalm 150.
And that's the thing about music.
Yes.
There is no rule for that. There shouldn't be rules for that, only for classical music, of course. That's the only thing that follows the rules. So, Robin, if people want to know more about Jewish music and more about the community here in D.C., where should they go for those who live in the DMV area?
Well, if they want to hear me singing Jewish music, they can go to my website, helzner.com, H-E-L-Z-N-E-R.
And get your CDs.
And get my CDs. Or check the schedule, the calendar, and find out when I'm giving concerts, when I'm giving presentations. And
you play only on the synagogues, or you play also in other venues?
All over the country, so they can find out when I'm leading services in any particular synagogue here in the D.C. area, but where also my trio will be giving concerts here in D.C. and also in other areas of the country. And also where I'm giving my musical presentations about the Jews of China, the Jews of Spain, the Jews of Russia.
I want to go to a trip with you and learn about Judeo-Espanol.
You're welcome.
There you go with you.
You are welcome.
Those trips
are welcome.
I mean, those trips, are they only in the part of where they were, or do you take them to Toledo and other places around Spain?
Oh, we took them everywhere. When we went to Spain, we took them all over.
How long is the trip? I mean, not a trip here from here to Spain, but how long does it take in days?
We usually do about 12 days.
Wow, that's nice.
12 days, yes. China, maybe 2 weeks, because it's a little
further
away.
A little bit farther.
My next tour, by the way, since you asked, my next tour is to Morocco. October 2019, we're traveling to Morocco, and we're going to, again, this is a heart of a Sephardic community in Morocco.
You're going to be there for how long?
12 days.
12 days as well?
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, a lot of spices there.
It's going to be very interesting. It's a mixture of North African and European
culture. Do you go by yourself, or do the trio goes with you as well?
Usually I'm the one that leads the group. And as we go from place to place, we learn songs. So when we were in Spain, we learned Sephardic songs throughout our journey. When we were in the Balkans, we learned a lot of Sephardic songs from the Balkans, from Sarajevo. And when we go to Morocco, we're going to be learning Moroccan Jewish songs.
That would be interesting.
That's part of what I like to offer when people come to me.
A
learning experience, not just of the country,
it's
but of the
music. Is only musicians that go with you, or they're
usually
different?
Just me.
But when also, you're the only one who goes to the places?
I use a travel agency,
okay.
So there are other guides, but I'm the one who organizes the group and leads.
But the
music.
Group are composed of musicians or
no,
people?
No, just people. People from my synagogues, people who hear me give a concert in Maine or Phoenix or
that wants to
Beijing
go with you and meet new people and meet new
experiences. Right,
and look the city from a different perspective.
From a Jewish perspective.
That would be awesome. Gosh. I have to make plans for that. If they want to know more about you, they just go to your website and check everything. They can also visit the historic synagogue. They have also a calendar there that sometimes you are there.
The Sixth Sinai Historic Synagogue, every fourth Friday, I'm at the Sixth Sinai.
And you will be the cantor there.
I'll be the cantor there. At Temple Sinai, I'm the cantor. Every first Friday and every first, second, and third Saturday morning.
Everyone is welcome.
Everyone is welcome.
Robin, thank you so much for your song. Thank you much for your time. This is a really great learning experience for myself. I really learned a lot. And for the tour of the synagogue, I never seen a Torah before. I mean, I've seen a movie.
Come back.
I love it. I love it. Who knows? Maybe we'll be here one day. So let's see. So thank you so much.
Shema. למה שהלל אומר שמה, למה שהלל אומר שמה, למה שהלל אומר הלל אומר שמה, למה שהלל אומר שמה, למה שהלל אומר שמה, למה שהלל אומר הלל אומר שמה. למה שהלל אומר שמה, למה שהלל אומר שמה, למה שהלל אומר הלל.
למה שהילל אומר שמע, למה שהילל אומר שמע, למה שהילל אומר, הילל אומר, הילל היה אומר, אם אין אני לי, מי לי, ושאני לעצמי מה אני.
למה שהילל לא אומר, שמע, למה שהילל לא אומר, שמע, למה שהילל לא אומר, הילל אומר, הילל היה אומר, אם אין אני לי, מי לי, ושאני לעצמי, מה אני, הילל היה אומר, אם אין אני לי, מי לי, ושאני לעצמי, מה אני.
To all my audience, thank you for listening to this episode and the previous ones. If you are new to Music in Two Flavors, Música en Dos Sabores, I want to let you know that every show is something meaningful and memorable. I welcome you, and I hope that you stay with us for our next musical adventure. As you have seen, this podcast is created by just one person, myself. I put a lot of energy, enthusiasm, and care in trying my best in bringing you something meaningful and memorable. That is why I invite you to share it on your social platforms in order to reach a broader audience and keep this musical community growing. We still have a long road to ride in a musical bus, or the magical bus if you are a Beatles fan. If you are already a Music in Two Flavors sustaining supporter, I thank you. If you're not, you can go to our website at www.musicintoflavors.com and remember, as I always say, the number 2 is a numerical character. And click on our Patreon banner to donate and support our show. Thank you and see you in our next episode of Music in Two Flavors, Música en Dos Sabores. Hasta luego.